Ave podcast listeners, a quick notice before we start the podcast today. The next episode of Emperors of Rome will be episode CL. Woo! So to celebrate our 150th episode, we will be convening a live episode via Zoom in lockdown. And you are welcome to come along and join the proceedings. So if you'd like to take part in a Q&A episode with myself, Kaelin Davenport and Rhiannon Evans, you can register now. The links are on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Hope to see you there. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany. This is episode CXLIX, Herodian. Herodian was a historian, living and writing during the reign of the Severan Dynasty. He's a valuable record of events for some of the most turbulent days of Roman history, and while at times lacking details, he knows what he's doing with an exciting narrative. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
Herodian wrote a history of the Roman Empire after the death of Marcus Aurelius, and it's in 8 books, and he wrote it in Greek. So the 8 books cover the period from 180, with the death of Marcus and the accession of Commodus, up to the year 238, which we know is as the year of the 6 emperors, and he ends with the accession of the 13-year-old Gordian III as Augustus in 238.
He didn't inject a lot of himself in it, did he? He kept it very kind of on topic.
That's right. So we don't actually know that much about Herodian himself. So that's all we know of his name. That's his cognomen or his last name, Herodianus. So he's Greek, but we don't know his praenomen or his nomen, which might have told us more information about, for example, when his family received Roman citizenship. So we can only have little glimpses that we find in the beginning of the history or in asides throughout the history. So we know he was a contemporary of the events he was describing. So at the beginning of the work in Book 1, Chapter 2, Section 5, he says, "I have written a history of the events following the death of Marcus, which I heard and saw in my lifetime."
So we've got, what is it? It's 58 years, isn't it, between those two events then? So if that's
right.
His lifetime, and I imagine he would have been old enough to remember that time frame as well.
Yeah, so at another point he says at Book 2, Chapter 15, Section 7, he refers the span of his life as 70 years at the time of writing, and he once again emphasises that he had personal knowledge of the emperors during this period. So it's probable that he was born towards the end of Marcus Aurelius's reign, so in the late 170s, which means that he would be an old man by about 238 or the 240s when he may or may not have been writing the work.
Well, I mean, you know, if he's saying that 70 years, he's definitely in old age by the time he's writing the end of this book, I suppose. He could have been writing parts of it during his life. But besides that, you know, that's kind of all we know. We don't know where he's from. We don't know what he did for a living. We can infer lots of things. But that's it. Okay, good podcast. Thanks for talking
to me. There is some speculation. So as historians, we love to speculate about these things. So there's a few other bits and pieces that we can tease out from his work, which tells us a bit more about Herodian the man. So we know, for example, that he saw some events that took place. So he describes Commodus's gladiatorial and beast hunting antics that take place in the games in 192, the year that culminates in Commodus's murder. He says in the history, and this is Book 1, Chapter 15.4, that we saw, idolmen, that's the Greek, we saw certain animals exhibited for the first time on this occasion. So Herodian would have been in Rome to see this. He would have been of age. So the noted Herodian scholar C.R. Whittaker talks about the fact that he would have had to wear the toga virilis, the toga of manhood, by this time in order to attend the games. So he's at least a youth at the end of Commodus's reign. And again, he tells us that he saw the Cicular Games staged by Septimius Severus in 204. And this is in Book 3, Chapter 8, Subsection 10. Again, he says, we saw these events taking place. My favourite piece of eyewitness testimony, although it's not precisely dated, refers to the statues of Caracalla. Those of you who have listened to the Caracalla podcast will remember Caracalla's fondness for Alexander the Great and wanting to emulate him. Herodian says in Book 4, Chapter 8, Section 2, and I quote here, "In some places we saw some ludicrous pictures portraying a single body surmounted by a head whose circumference was split into two half faces, one of Alexander and one of Antoninus," that is Caracalla's real name. So he said that he saw these fantastic statues that are half Alexander's face, half Caracalla's face. I wish some of these survived, but it's great eyewitness testimony for Caracalla's Alexander mania.
The sense that we get for these, so we know that he was a learned man then. He seemed to take the job of writing a history very seriously, i.e. you don't interject yourself. And we've seen other Roman historians do the same sort of thing. So Tacitus didn't interject himself a lot in his works, but Dio more so saw it as being useful as saying when he saw something happen. But then again, he was in the Senate and could see the emperors firsthand, I suppose, towards the end of his reign.
Yes, that's very true. So Dio is the biggest point of comparison with Herodian because we know they were alive at the same time. And Dio is always telling us, you know, we senators did this, you know, we passed this decree, we acclaimed the emperors, that, you know, we were poorly treated. And Dio tells us, you know, the names and lives and family backgrounds of senators and equestrians. Dio's Roman history is full of what we call prospographical detail, which is basically a fancy way of saying information about people. So Dio talks about the senatorial order as a whole, and really Dio and the Senate are inseparable from the Roman history, particularly the contemporary books. But we don't get any sense of that with Herodian. So he never really tells us what his social status was. There's a very cryptic remark at the beginning. So in Book 1, Chapter 2, Section 5, he says, "I had a personal share in some of these events during my imperial and public service." But we don't know what that was. It's probable he's not a senator, given that he doesn't have all the intricate details that Dio provides. It could be that he was an equestrian procurator, that's been suggested, or a municipal magistrate. So someone that would serve as a councillor in a town, perhaps Antioch, if he was from there. Other suggestions include that he was a freedman, perhaps an imperial freedman. And it wasn't unknown for freedmen to write history. For example, Phlegon of Tralles, a freedman under Hadrian, wrote history in the 2nd century AD. So he held some position, but we don't know what. But what's key is that that position, that status, isn't central to the way that he tells history in the same way that it is for Cassius Dio.
Yeah, I guess it's very lucky that he dropped that phrase imperial and public service in there, because otherwise he could just be a well-read slave who can read and write, who's owned by the right person. You know, we get so little about him in his work. I just find an interesting kind of detective kind of thing to go through his text and try and draw out what you can about him.
And historians have been doing this for generations, centuries, so there are so many theories. One thing that a recent scholar, Adam Camizus, has pointed out is that Herodian didn't want to be seen in his text the same way that Dio was. So he's deliberately hiding who he is, or that, you know, being an official is not central to the way that he writes history. But that doesn't, of course, stop us from speculating. We know, for example, he's Greek. I mean, he writes in Greek, but where he comes from in the Greek world is unknown. Antioch is a good suggestion because he describes events there in detail. So is Asia Minor, so particularly the western coast of what is now Turkey. He shows a lot of interest in that area and it provides specific details. It's not Italy. He says that the Alps are bigger than anything in our part of the world, and that's in Book 2, Chapter 11, Subsection 8. So wherever he was from, it wasn't very mountainous. So we can play the guessing game. He does explain Roman customs, so it suggests his audience at least doesn't live in Rome, or his intended audience doesn't live in Rome. So he explains the process of apotheosis, becoming a deified emperor for his audience, which presumes that they may not necessarily be familiar with the mechanics of how that takes place. So there's an insight there that perhaps he thinks his audience are somehow are outside the mainstream of imperial politics or events in the Roman world.
That comment about the Alps as well would kind of lend evidence to that, because he said they're larger than anything in our area of the world. That infers that his audience are quite away from Italy and somewhere flatter.
Exactly. So perhaps, you know, a coastal region, but you know, we can play the guessing game all day, and it's quite fun, and you know, has kept many scholars employed for quite some time. At the end of the day, perhaps it's not the most important thing about his history.
So when did he write it? We know that he wrote it towards the end of his life, but do we have indications of that sort of thing, or why he was writing it at that time?
He wrote it at least in 238 or later, because that's when the work ends with the accession of Gordian III. So the ending, I'll just read it out. And this is Book 8, Chapter 8, Section 8, 8.8.8. Gordian, aged about 13, was saluted as emperor and took over the Roman Empire.
So that's what, just as soon as the ascension happened, close the book?
As Augustus, yes. So yeah, he's been proclaimed Caesar earlier with Pupienus and Balbinus, who feature in our Year of the Six Emperors podcast.
Yeah.
And then, yes, we have this line. It's boom. It's done.
He planned that well for 8.8.8, didn't he?
Yes.
Don't worry. I know that those are modern numbers.
Yeah, modern numbers. That's okay. Still, it's a nice ending.
Right. So he didn't feel it appropriate / necessary to go into the reign of Gordian III or beyond if he was writing it during those times?
Yeah, so this is the really difficult question. It depends on how we read that last line. Mm. And as with Herodian's place of origin, a lot of ink has been spilt over how we read this line. So C.R. Whittaker, who I mentioned before, who translated Herodian for the Lurb, says that this is a, and I quote, somber conclusion which could not have been written under Gordian III, who was a teenage emperor. We would expect perhaps some praise for him and the dawning of a new age with, you know, youthful vigour and hope. Whittaker also points out that young emperors generally don't get a good write-up in Herodian. So, for example, when he discusses Gordian III's proclamation as Caesar, Herodian says, and this is Book 7, Chapter 10, Section 9, Gordian III was not made Augustus because he was too young to be placed in charge of the government, so too young to be elevated to Augustus. On young emperors in general, Herodian says, and this is the beginning of the work, Book 1.1.6, and I quote here, "The very young ones led rather less disciplined lives and brought in many innovations. This disparity in age and authority naturally resulted in different activities." So the implication here is that, you know, people like Caracalla, Geta, Elagabalus, these are not the sort of people you want in charge. You don't want the young and inexperienced. They like to race chariots and cavort with prostitutes. And he doesn't say any of that stuff about Gordian III, but some scholars have thought that the implication might be that, you know, you don't want to publish this under a young emperor.
Yeah, it's really kind of interesting when you think about the emperors that he's lived through, how that must cloud what your perception of it is to be an emperor, or to be, even to be a good emperor. You know, he's gone through Caracalla, Septimius Severus, he's gone through Domitian. And I guess for him, a good emperor would have been Septimius Severus, I guess. Somebody who wasn't terrible.
Yeah, I mean, the best emperor is the one who isn't really discussed. It's Marcus Aurelius. So this is why he starts with Marcus.
But he would have been young then. He wouldn't have remembered a lot about that reign.
Exactly. So it may be sort of rose-tinted glasses. I mean, you know, he's probably a boy. So from what he knows and what he's read, he thinks Marcus is the best emperor. Septimius Severus, of those he actually describes, probably comes off one of the best. There's a sort of a change in the nature of emperors between those he calls tyrants and those that are aristocrats or lead an aristocratic form of government. And this basically means they involve the Senate and they're not out to murder people indiscriminately and that sort of thing. Through this, he does form a conception of what makes a good emperor. And it is suggestive that the young ones are not so well received. The question is, would that have mattered? I mean, if Herodian is writing, say, in Antioch, he publishes his work by circulating it through friends there, is this something that would come to the attention of the emperors? Some scholars have said, well, actually, writing under Gordian III was no problem. The ending is not as pessimistic as it seems. He doesn't outright criticize the emperor. The emperor is not necessarily as all-knowing as we would think. And it's certainly a far cry from, for example, Aelian's denunciation of a womanly man about Elagabalus, which he was too scared to deliver while Elagabalus was alive and was criticised for that because he wouldn't speak truth to power. But, you know, that, you know, by its title, a denunciation of a womanly man, and goes in to talk about Elagabalus's effeminity and, you know, strange Syrian practices. That's a far cry from what we see in Herodian. It may be he was writing under Gordian III. It may be that he was writing under Gordian's successor, Philip, in the late 240s. Suggestions have even placed it as late as the reign of Gallienus in the 260s, but there's really not much positive evidence for that. So all we can say is that 238 or later, and the jury's out on whether it was dangerous to write this under Gordian III.
I think that if I was writing it under Philip, then Gordian III would be a good place to end it, because you don't want to write about how Philip came to power necessarily.
No, that's a good point. Yes, so Philip, for those of you who don't know, was Praetorian prefect of Gordian III. And depending on who you believe, there are various stories. Gordian III rides to battle against the Persians, and either he's killed in battle or Philip kills him in battle and claims that he was killed. There are good reasons for perhaps glossing over that particular sort of point in imperial history.
I found as well that he was a very good storyteller, to the extent that sometimes I've gone, let's do a whole episode on this event because Herodian tells it really well. I think there was a siege, maybe a battle that Caracalla did. The entire attack on Alexandria.
Where, the massacre, yes.
Yes, yes, where he told that in really vivid detail. And I've gone, this isn't an episode all by itself just because Herodian's such a good storyteller on it. There's some events, and especially battles, where he makes it jump off the page a lot more than Dio was, I find.
Yeah, there's some great other ones, like the murder of Plautianus, Plautianus's downfall in Book 3. That's a gripping story. The Red Wedding story, which we told in the Caracalla episode, probably is, you know, completely fictional. It's very different from how Dio tells the breakdown of relationship between the Romans and the Parthians. But no, it's gripping stuff. He's a very good writer.
So what can you tell us about Herodian's methodology then? What was his intention behind writing it?
He has some key methodological statements in Book 1 of the history. So in Book 1.1.4, he tells us that it is a period of great upheaval, and that makes it worth discussing. So he says, and I quote, A comparative survey of the period of about 200 years from Augustus, the point at which the regime became a monarchy, to the age of Marcus would reveal no such similar successions of reigns, variety of fortunes in both civil and foreign wars, disturbances amongst the provincial populations, and destructions of cities in both Roman territory and many barbarian countries. There have never been such earthquakes and plagues, or tyrants and emperors with such unexpected careers, which were rarely, if ever, recorded before.
Mm.
So he says, you know, when you look at the period from Augustus up to Marcus, yes, there have been problems, but nothing compares to this age of 58 years between Commodus and the year of the six emperors. There's wars, there's downfalls, earthquakes as well, and particularly this turnover of tyrants and emperors. That's really important there. So you get someone like Commodus, who is a tyrant. His murder brings about the restoration of aristocratic government involving the Senate under Pertinax. But as we know, he doesn't last that long. Elagabalus is a tyrant. Then we go to Severus Alexander with aristocratic government. And then he's murdered, and Maximinus is a tyrant. So it's about how emperors rose and fell. And this means he's not so interested in the nitty-gritty. His narrative really focuses on the ups and downs of imperial history.
It sounds like he wants to cover this as well because it's an exciting thing to cover. And that comes out, I guess, in his writing and the way that he delivers it. As you said, he's not so much worried about the particulars of Roman governance. Mm. He's more so worried about the big events and where the action is.
Definitely, definitely. So, you know, when he talks about in his methodology, he says, and this is very commonplace for ancient historians, you know, that he hasn't accepted second-hand information that has not been checked and corroborated. This is in 1.1.3. He says, you know, he's made an attempt at accuracy, limiting it to what falls within the recent memory of my readers. So presumably he's initially writing for people who would have lived through some of these events. And then he goes on to say, and this is really important, and I quote here, "But I believe that future generations too will derive some pleasure from the knowledge of events which are important and compressed within a brief span of time."
Mm.
This is really important. History should be enjoyable, which I think is really good. I mean, often we forget that nowadays, but lots of ancient authors would say, you know, "I want to bring pleasure, enjoyment, entertainment to my readers. Yes, I'm writing about important things, but in order to get the message across, it has to be enjoyable in some sense."
Is there an indication there as well that he might be aware that there's other authors who can maybe fill in the details that he's going past?
Oh, definitely. I mean, he does tell us about the works of other historians that have been written. For example, when he talks about the Battle of Lugdunum between Septimius Severus and Clodius Albinus in 197, he says, and I quote from 3.7.6, "Contemporary historians vary the total number of casualties and prisoners on either side to suit their own purposes." So, you know, we know that battle numbers in the ancient historians are mostly just made up. They really can't be trusted. They knew that in the ancient world very often as well. He knew, for example, Septimius Severus's autobiography. Whether he used Cassius Dio is a difficult question to answer. That's almost missed the point. He's writing history his way. It's going to tell us about the turnover of emperors and why it's such a turbulent period. And you're going to enjoy it while you're reading it as well.
Mm.
And I think that if we read it in that way, we actually derive a lot more satisfaction from Herodian. I love the account at the end of book one of Commodus's games, for example, when, you know, he's fighting in the arena, you know, conducting beast hunts. And this is something that Herodian himself tells us that he saw as a young man. So it obviously made an impression. I'd just like to read out one particular passage, which I very much like from this, which I think shows how Herodian is really getting into things. This is book 1, chapter 15, section 7. "So far, Commodus was still quite popular with the mob, even if his conduct, apart from his courage and marksmanship, was unfitting for an emperor. But when he ran into the amphitheatre, stripped and carrying his weapons for gladiatorial fight, the people were ashamed to see a Roman emperor of noble lineage, whose father and forebears had all celebrated great triumphs, now disgracing his office with a thoroughly degrading exhibition, instead of using his weapons to fight the barbarians and prove himself worthy of the Roman Empire. He had no difficulty in overcoming his opponents in gladiatorial fights by merely wounding them, since they all looked upon him as the emperor rather than as a gladiator, and let him win. But his madness reached such a stage that he even refused to stay in the palace any longer and was intending to go and live with the gladiators in their barracks. I just think that's great. You know, it's a fantastic, you know, denunciation of Commodus, you know, befouling the position of emperor in that way. You know, he's not going out and fighting in person. He just does it in the safe environment of the arena where everyone knows he's emperor, so they'll let him win.
But it's interesting that he didn't decide to mention Russell Crowe in that.
I mean, that is a really key point, which I missed out, you know. Where is Maximus? That's what I'd like to know.
Okay, so maybe a good way to understand how Herodian was writing and where he was coming from would be to compare him directly with something that Dio was writing. So do you have anything that would be a good example of that?
Yeah, so Dio and Herodian both give great descriptions of imperial funerals. So in Dio's case, it's that of Pertinax, the short-lived emperor in 193. And in Herodian's case, it's the funeral of Septimius Severus in 211. And what's really interesting is that in Dio's description, he is one of the participants. He talks about us senators walking around in state, participating in these events. Whereas Herodian takes the view much more of an outsider. It's part of his attempt to explain Roman customs, such as deification, to his audience. I'll quote now from the beginning of Book 4. So this is Book 4, Chapter 2. Point one on the funeral of Septimius Severus. It is normal Roman practice to deify emperors who die leaving behind them children as their successors. The name they give to this ceremony is apotheosis. And then he goes on to describe the funeral pyre on the Campus Martius. And this is 4.2.6 to 8. Inside, the building is completely filled with brushwood, and outside it is decorated with gold-embroidered drapery, ivory carvings, and a variety of paintings. On top of this structure, there is another one of the same shape and with the same decoration, but smaller and with open windows and doors. On top of this are a third and a fourth tier, each smaller than the last, until finally comes the smallest of all. One might compare the shape of the structure to the lighthouses which stand at the harbours and guide ships at night to safe anchorage. The general name for these lighthouses is Pharos. So if anyone's seen the coins which show the emperor's funeral pyres, just Google away, use Google Images, the Consecratio coins, the image of the pyre really matches Herodian's description. It's almost like a wedding cake, all these different tiers getting smaller as you go up to the top. But it's this kind of interesting observational ethnographic detail almost, which makes Herodian such an interesting author.
It's almost like he saw that happen. There's a lot of detail there.
There's a lot of detail, yes. So C.R. Whittaker says he was probably in Rome in the end of Commodus's reign. He talks about the fire then, and he talks about witnessing the games. He was there in Septimius Severus's in 204, so it's plausible he could be there again in 211 to see this fantastic funeral event take place.
See, I'm doing it again. I'm back to mystery hunting, aren't I?
No, that's okay. All historians do it, Matt. You're in excellent company. We want to find out things that we don't know.
While this isn't a widely read historiography, it is a work that we've got from start to finish, which is rare for a Roman history. We don't have all of Tacitus. We don't have all of Dio. Mm. We're even missing the very start of Suetonius.
That's right.
But we've got all of Herodian from first word to the last word.
No, that's a really important point. It means we can study his work as a whole. We can see how he sets up themes at the beginning of the work. We can see how they're brought to conclusion. And in this, we can see that the main theme really is, you know, the rise and fall of emperors, this constant turnover, the turbulence, the civil war during this period. So although he may not have been someone super important like Dio, he does provide us with a sense that this was, a period of great uncertainty and crisis. And he's especially valuable for the account of the reign of Maximinus and the year of the six emperors in 238. And that is a really gripping narrative as well. You know, how Gordon the First, is made emperor in Carthage, and he's surrounded by the youths there. And then we have the riots in Rome. And then we have the murder of Pupienus and Balbinus in the palace, leaving us with this 13-year-old boy. He's a really important, but also understudied author.
So what can be said about him as a historical source then? And I'm actually quite interested in what answer you give here, because when I was doing the Emperors of Rome as a podcast, Herodian wasn't relied on heavily as a source while there were other options. Does that make sense? When you had Dio, you relied more on him before you hit the epitomized areas of that. And when you had overlaps with other historians, you kind of go, well, Herodian's the kind of last source that you wade into. So what's the perception of him as a historical source then?
You're right. I mean, Dio ruled supreme for historians of the Severan period because he was a senator. He provides us with really detailed accounts of what's happening in the Senate, of letters that are being sent there. You know, he talks about his friends. He gives names and details. And, you know, when I was starting out as a historian, I would get very frustrated with Herodian because there aren't that many names. So, you have emperors, imperial family members, Praetorian prefects, occasionally, not always, sometimes freedmen. It's people that are involved in murders or plots or downfalls. You don't really get a sense of the nitty-gritty of imperial history. Cassius Dio is much more Tacitean in that way. So I was very frustrated. Now I have come to appreciate what a good storyteller a Herodian is. His narrative is really exciting. And I think, when you're looking at it for, names, dates and places, that's very different from just sitting down and reading it. And I would encourage listeners, if they have a chance, just to sit down and read Herodian. There's an English translation on livius.org, or there's the 2-volume Loeb edition, which is excellent. Just sit down and read it as a work of history. And you do get carried away with, the rise and fall of emperors.
That's Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review, they are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Kaelin on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. I'll catch you next time in episode CL. So until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.